Welcome to another edition of Raising San Radio. I'm Susan Gallimore with the Beatles and Uncle Albert. Hands Around the Water and Hands Across the Sand was the order of the day on Saturday, June 26th, when members of beach and water communities across the United States and in about 50 other countries formed a line at the water's edge, grasped one another's hands, and sang or listened or simply gazed at the beauty of the surroundings and grieved for the plant and animal life endangered or already lost by the Gulf of Mexico oil catastrophe. We spend our hour today looking at oil disasters, including some that were very similar to or of greater magnitude than the Gulf disaster and which have received very little attention in the United States. We look at the Kimberley region in the north of Western Australia, a pristine wilderness under threat by industries in search of resources. First, though, the U.S. Social Forum ran from June 22nd to June 26th, and about 20,000 people attended. We had a link on our website, raisingsandradio.org, that you could listen to. I hope you did, and if you didn't, there might still be some information that you can be listening to from that. So go to the website, raisingsandradio.org, and you'll find it on the homepage. Carol DeVora organized the event in Alameda, California, which is my hometown and a small island in the San Francisco Bay. We've had our share of oil spills in the San Francisco Bay, especially recently, but none, of course, on a par with the Gulf. I talked to Carol DeVora at Crown Beach after the event. This is Carol DeVora, who is the coordinator organizer of today's event. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
So, good event.
Yes, it was actually an amazing turnout because we expected anywhere from 25 to 100 people, and we got 125.
Oh, that's great.
So, we're really thrilled that so many people showed up. There are events all over the Bay Area, and we're happy that people showed up here at Alameda, at Crown Beach.
And Carol, why did you decide to do this today?
I was very distressed by what happened in the Gulf. 11 people were killed. Countless numbers of wildlife are dying, and beaches are being fouled all over the Gulf Coast. And I was very distraught about it and feeling very powerless. And then on a website, a million signatures or something against oil drilling, I saw Hands Across the Sand. I linked up with them, and they said, have an event on your beach, and so I did.
And that was part of MoveOn.org, wasn't it?
There are many sponsors, the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, the Oceanic Society, MoveOn, Greenpeace. There were many, especially environmental sponsors, there were many who endorsed this and put them on the website.
And I got an email sometime earlier this week. So actually, this was pulled together very quickly.
Oh, yes. This started about 2.5 weeks ago for me. I really expected people from Berkeley to do something. So I thought this would be just kind of a small event. And then there was no one signed up to do an event in Berkeley. So it turned out to be a one-woman enterprise, me.
Well, thank you for doing it. I think that people are really concerned and also touched by an event like this.
I think there are many people who felt the same way that I did, that they were very disturbed about it, very distraught. That we were signing petitions. 350.org had one, Move On. There are many petitions going around, but personally, you felt like you wanted to do more. And I think by organizing this event, Hands Across the Sand, drew on that energy. And hopefully they are all over the United States in over 650 different sites, many in Marin and in San Francisco, a large one I know at Ocean Beach, and also worldwide at 50 international sites. So we're hoping that the leaders of this country get the message strongly that we are saying, which is no to offshore oil drilling and a resounding yes to clean energy alternatives. We need to find an alternative to fossil fuels. This event has shown us that there is no oil drilling without risk, and the risk can be catastrophic, just like nuclear energy has a supreme risk, as Chernobyl showed the world. The Gulf catastrophe is showing the world that offshore oil drilling is not safe.
Carol, what do you think about the news reports that people are being prevented from actually getting close down to the Gulf in Louisiana and Mississippi and those places? Do you think we're actually seeing the extent of the problem?
Well, I know that there's a lot of press coverage. Anderson Cooper and CNN has been down on the Gulf and is doing excellent reporting. Other people, Rachel Maddow is doing excellent reporting on MSNBC. I think we're getting a good story from independent investigators. I don't think we're getting a good story from BP, who is certainly minimizing the events and the risks.
Yeah. And, well, you can see there that they would have to do that, right? they're kind of on the hook.
They are. Their stock is going down. And at the same time, they have applied for a license to drill offshore in the waters of Alaska, which they say is really not offshore because they built an artificial island. And this is how they're getting away with it. And we've already experienced the Exxon Valdez in Alaska, and we don't need any more. And I do want to just add the connection to Crown Beach and why, of all the beaches in the East Bay, we chose Crown Beach because during the oil spill of the Casco Busan, which was in 2007, 54,000 gallons of oil was spilled when it hit the bridge, much of which landed in Crown Beach, and the beach was closed for quite some time, as it was in 2009 in November when there was another oil spill.
So we've Dubai, had a lot of Dubai Star.
Dubai Star. So we've had oil spills that a lot of people aren't aware of, and the beaches have been fouled and closed at that point. Now, in the Gulf, by comparison, 200,000 gallons of oil every day is leaking into the Gulf by comparison. And 54,000 gallons of oil total one day fouled beaches all along Alameda and Berkeley. So,
thank you for being with us, Carol Devora.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here and seeing us.
Was Carol Devora, organizer of the event in Alameda. Julie Rufo was there too. With me is Julie Rufo at Crown Beach. Julie, what are you doing here today?
I'm here to make a statement. I think that people feel utterly powerless and helpless about this horrible oil leak in the Gulf. There's nothing any of us can do. And I think this gives people an opportunity at least to come out and speak their minds about how much they are against offshore oil drilling.
Did you have a chance to talk with other people in line with you? There were, about 150 people or so.
Yeah, I think about that. Yeah, I talked to a few people here. Everybody has very strong feelings about what's happening in the Gulf. It's destroying the Gulf environment probably for generations and generations, and it's going to make people sick. And I think most people are here simply because it's the only way they have to express their feelings about it.
And Julie Rufa, do you tend to be involved in community issues in this town?
Yes, in Alameda and in the world. I do some work for the Free Gaza Movement and with other organizations, so I'm very politically attuned. I'm a news junkie, so I am as involved as I can be. I also run the website for the Alameda Peace Network. That's www.alamedapeacenetwork.org, where we try to keep up to date on local events in Alameda and in the Bay Area in general, and I also post articles that I think that are of particular interest for people to read about what's going on in the world, particularly in the Middle East.
Thanks for being with us, Julie Rufo. And now we're going to turn to Fred Dean, who is here with his dog Piper. Hi, Fred.
Hi.
What are you doing here today?
Well, actually, I'm one of Julie's disciples.
What does that mean?
Well, actually, when Julie calls me out, it's like I got to go. And actually, I feel sickened as well about what's going on in the Gulf, and I think it's in line with the other disasters we've seen in the last couple of years.
And so do you feel as though there are things you can do about it personally?
I feel frustrated, but I feel that you have to be honest in your dealings with other people and let them know how you feel and spread the word if you can, spread the truth.
And you're from this little town also?
Yes, I've been here about 15 years in Alameda.
And for a moment, describe it to people, because I think that it's one of those places that gets lost a lot because it's kind of hidden Bay Area secret.
You know, it certainly is. You know, I tried to do a vacation exchange and I started writing about the town of Alameda and the beaches. We're standing right now by it's a world-class windsurfing academy. They have wineries, distilleries, live music at McGrath's is a good place, and a tiki lounge. So the 4th of July parade's coming up, the biggest parade in the Bay Area.
And it's really kind of a quote-unquote old-fashioned scene, that parade, isn't it? It's got a real old feel to it, Americana.
You know, that's right. Actually, I was been in the parade the last few years. Last year, I marched with Code Pink, and a couple of years before that, I my wife's got a toy store, and we had a float, and I spent days building a sailboat that I pushed on this, pushed around. It was made from a garbage caddy, and I pushed it along the whole parade route, and dressed up as a pirate.
Well, thanks for being with us, and thanks for being out here today.
Thank you so much. It's a beautiful day.
I just ran into Marilyn Wilson, who ran across very excited because Marilyn is from Florida and wanted to be part of this today. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, how are you? Yes, we're accidentally here. We were in Yosemite this morning at 9:30, and I knew I was missing the Hands Across the Sand in Jacksonville Beach, and I was very frustrated. But they said, well, look on the website. And sure enough, I looked on the website, and there was one in Alameda where I graduated in 1965.
Oh, welcome back.
Thank you. And so we're dashing up the highway. My husband, Frank, drops me off here in the corner, and everybody's dispersing.
Oh.
And I just run down. But Pat and Carol were just so great to pull it all together, and we did another makeshift Hands Across the Sand. And so our pictures are going to go to Maggie Fitzroy with Florida Times Union in Jacksonville. And she's going to do a story and connect Alameda, California, and Jacksonville Beach, Florida.
Excellent. Well, it's wonderful to have you back. And has this town changed a lot since you were here?
Well, it has changed a lot. In fact, if I didn't have GPS, I would have never found the beach. And I used to drive on this, drive around up and down the beach. So we were thrilled to get here. We were headed to San Francisco and to fly home.
Oh.
Yeah,
wow.
Tomorrow. So this was just a coup that I was able to be here, at 12 o'clock here. When it's really 3 o'clock now in Florida, and they did theirs. They did theirs
already,
at noon, and they had 260 people. And I understand you had 125. So it's happening. It's working.
What is it like in Florida? Has oil reached there yet?
Not in the Jacksonville side. The Gulf, it's there. We're all still going to the beaches in the Gulf, and the restaurants are really struggling because they're not getting shipments. We see it on television. It's sad, and we all have our fingers crossed. We just have our fingers crossed because what's going to be left if we keep having to close our ports and our shorelines? It's just so sad. What about you guys? How do you feel the effect will be?
Yes, we're all affected by this, and I think when we think about what's going on in Nigeria, we start to get a sense of what could be possible here.
We absolutely do. Well, I'm a part of a group of drummers, and I have a little women's band called Heart to Heart Circles, and we do healing ceremonies at the ocean for this oil spill, and we bring in water from home, and we're just doing little ceremonies around them and, pouring it back into the waters. Just, anything as prayer requests that we're putting out there. The Indian chiefs, the American Native Indian chiefs are, sending out special prayers for us all to give. And so we're doing things like that. We've written a couple songs we're going to put up on YouTube.
There was a segment from our Hands Across the Sands event in Alameda, California, one of hundreds held around the world on June 26th.
Hands across the water, hands across the sky, hands across the water, hands across the sky.
As things unfold in the Gulf of Mexico, more and more Americans are learning about oil spills that have happened in other parts of the world, many of which are simply part of everyday life in some places. think of the Niger Delta, Ecuador, and we'll learn today in Australia. Recently, a visitor from Australia, Josh Coates of the Wilderness Society Australia, talked about environmental pressures in the Kimberley region in north of Western Australia. Before we turn to Josh Coates, a brief overview that the Kimberley region of northern Western Australia is one of the world's great and natural indigenous cultural regions. Its vast savanna landscapes, wild rivers, extensive wetlands, spectacular coast, and rich marine environments provide a multitude of habitats that are home to an extraordinary diversity of species. Incredibly, the far northwest Kimberley subregion is the only part of Western Australia and one of the few in Australia that appears to have retained its complete native fauna species diversity without extinction since European settlement. Here is a short clip from the Australian television show 60 Minutes that gives a pretty good summary of what is at stake and who are the players. The host of the show is Tara Brown, and the naturalist is Peter Tucker. The piece is called Battle for the Kimberley, and I will have a link to this video on the website. It's really worth watching. It's quite spectacular, this region.
There is one wild and wonderful place right here in Australia, the mighty Kimberley, that vast, pristine corner of the far northwest. It's drop-dead gorgeous, like nothing on earth. And wouldn't you know it, this paradise is also jam-packed with natural resources just waiting to be dug up and sold. The perfect ingredients for a world-class stoush, a battle that will decide the fate of one of the last true wilderness areas on Earth. A world away from the red brick views and broadband speed of city life, I'm travelling into the Great Northwest, the deep heart of the Kimberley, with local bushman Peter Tucker. So remote and rugged, there's hardly a dirt track for hundreds of kilometres along this stretch of coast. Getting around is by float plane, then boat, which happens to be the fastest way to meet the locals.
So is he one of your pet?
Pet, yeah, they're all my pets. That's a big Queensland groper. He'll, I'm sure he's hungry.
Will he come out of the water?
There you go.
This is your home sweet home.
This is my abode for about 7 months of the year.
Peter Tucker has been showing intrepid types around this unkempt corner of the Kimberley for 14 years. But Peter fears that the Kimberley, as he knows and loves it, is under serious threat. So he's founded the Save the Kimberley movement.
It's one of the most diverse and richest coastlines on the earth. We know more about the moon and Mars than we do about the Kimberley coastline. This place is worthy of preserving. I think it's a very simple argument.
But beauty is not the Kimberley's only asset. It's also resource-rich. And the fate of this place is coming to a head now because of a plan to mine billions of dollars in offshore natural gas. And it would be piped here, to this stretch of beach. Australian resources company Woodside is proposing to drill for the liquid natural gas 400 kilometres offshore, then pipe it to a processing plant on this spot, just 60 k's north of Broome. The 20 square kilometre LNG facility would look something like this one, which sits down the coast in Western Australia's mining heartland, the Pilbara. The proposal's got the powerful backing of Western Australian Premier Colin Barnett.
This is one beach, one area, very pretty, one in thousands of kilometres of Kimberley coastline. Thousands.
So you're saying bring on the gas?
For this project, yes I am. The gas has been piped ashore, put through a big refrigerator and sent out in shipping.
You'll see it. Flaming flares, machinery fences and exclusion zone. Does that sit easily with the image of the Kimberley?
Well, this plant, yes, you will see it. But it's not a heavy industrial complex. The Kimberley is not being changed significantly by this project. This is a pinprick in a vast landscape.
We're losing an Australian icon, a real gem, a diamond, that if we lose it, we just won't get it back.
For scientists like rivers expert Martin Toms, it's the vastness and unexplored nature of the Kimberley that makes it so unique and so important.
When I come across a river system as pristine as this, but also as the other rivers within the Kimberley, you go, you beauty. You really do, you know?
The Kimberley's grandeur inspires big dreams to match. Dreams of developers and conservationists that clash like the geological fault lines which have shaped this landscape over millions of years, in just the same way they do today.
Look at that. To you and I, that's just muck.
That is muck.
That is muck, isn't it? Yeah. But it's actually organic matter. It's carbon. It's energy. That's the stuff that drives riverine ecosystems.
So what you're saying in very simple terms, this river ain't stuffed.
Got it in one.
We've got the Amazon, got Antarctica and the Sahara, and Australia's got the Kimberley. It's 120 million years old. It's been around for a long, long time.
Well, of course, the developers and the government say they have done their homework. They believe that they've found the best site to do the least damage to the Kimberley. Do you believe them?
No. I don't think that you can put your hand on your heart and say there's going to be no impact, no significant impact.
Not losing one known species to extinction, not one, is a claim to fame unique to the Kimberley. But it's one scientists warn could well be at risk.
We're going to go and have a look at a sawfish with Dean.
And to prove the point, Martin's taking me on a late-night search for an ancient underwater wonder.
So there's a snag up here on the right.
Helping is Dr. Dean Thorburn. He's an expert in sawfish, a species that dates back to the dinosaurs and not so long ago could be found all over the globe. In recent times, it's been all but wiped out everywhere else, except here on the Fitzroy River.
Oh!
So, okay, we've got a big animal here.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Look at that.
So, yeah. If you start to feel a twist, mate, make sure you let it go.
Well, what is your fascination with sawfish?
When I first started studying them, I found it hard to believe there was a ray that looked more like a shark that grew up in a river to 3 metres, that then went out and grew to 7, and that had a saw on its head. Just to look at it as such a unique animal that needs to be looked after.
The Kimberley has one of the best environmental records ever. No extinctions, not one. Do you really want to tamper with that?
This plant will have no impact on the wildlife at all. Absolutely none. This is clean, high technology, clean gas for clean power generation.
But as sublime as this landscape is, it's no paradise for many of the people who live here. The majority of the Kimberley's residents are indigenous, many living in communities that are despairing and dysfunctional.
We'd be lucky to find one person with a job in this community, and this is what the gas negotiation's been about.
Wayne Bergman heads the Kimberley Land Council. He and many traditional owners have given the gas plant proposal crucial support.
This is about saving our people, about creating an opportunity.
In exchange, they've been promised more than $1 billion in Indigenous jobs, housing, health and education. The deal has wrong-footed and outraged many environmentalists.
This agreement is more than just mere compensation. It's about empowering Aboriginal people to be trained, employed.
Will any part of you accept that traditional owners have sold out?
No, because I'm not going to sit on my hands, put my head in the sand and say, somebody's going to come and save us and help us. We're taking charge to make a difference ourselves.
But not everyone's buying the billion-dollar promise. Do you think their opinions have been bought?
Definitely. Definitely. And I just think, you know, it's really sad.
100 kilometres up the coast from the proposed gas plant site, traditional owner, Albert Wigan, is getting dinner.
Down the hatchet, just mind the shelves that are broken in there.
Alvin.
Albert is spearheading opposition to Woodside's gas plans.
Not bad at all.
And Albert's as passionate in his views about the gas plant as he is about bush tucker.
Gas plants will come and go, and they will be going forever and a day. But you only get the Kimberleys once, and this rugged and this wild and this beautiful wilderness will only come once. And this is our chance to keep it that way.
Or your chance to lose it.
Or our chance to lose it.
Albert's convinced a gas plant down the coast will be the thin edge of the wedge, opening up the Kimberley for wider mining and development, scarring this pristine environment by turning it into another resources powerhouse, just like WA's Pilbara region.
What I'm concerned about is going to happen in the next 50 to 100 years. If we continue to teach our children that the only alternative they have to improving their livelihood and their self-determination is by sacrificing country, well then, in 50 to 100 years' time, we're not going to have any country left.
So you don't think the money, the jobs, the better services are going to be delivered to the people of the Kimberley?
I don't believe it whatsoever.
Is it the beginning of the end for the Kimberley?
No, it's the beginning of the beginning for the Kimberley. Because for the first time in decades and decades, there is a real hope for Aboriginal people.
Given the conditions most Aboriginal people live in, did they really have any choice but to sell out?
Look, I actually, if I can say so with respect, resent that implication.
Why is that?
No one is selling out, and no one has been pressured or forced into this. And I've got to say, I think it's a little bit patronising to Aboriginal people to suggest that they are not capable of making a decision for their own future.
No, poverty isn't equivalent to ignorance. I'm not saying that. But if you are poor, do you have a choice?
If the Aboriginal people had a choice, they know they have made a courageous decision for their children and generations to come, and I commend them for that.
It seems extraordinary to me that you can only get basic human rights, health, education, housing, if you agree to build a gas plant.
I mean, the rest of Australia, I think, finally is waking up to the fact that we as a community have failed Aboriginal people, particularly children. And I've got an opportunity perhaps no other Premier has had before to actually do something about it.
Opponents of the gas plant hold out high hopes that the Kimberley can trade on its beauty, that tourism can become a big jobs generator. And with vistas like this, you can see why tourism operators like Peter Tucker are so hopeful.
Mealtime.
It's mealtime. Dugongs, turtles, big tiger sharks, all sorts of fish.
To go to the Kimberley is certainly to go on a fresh air adventure. An adrenaline-packed experience where nature's very much in control. If you've never heard of or seen the Kimberley till now, expect to hear much more about it in the future. Environmentalists say it's got the makings of a stoush as big and unruly as the landscape itself. For Peter Tucker, the battle has only just begun, and he's getting ready to fight on the beaches, literally, if need be, for future generations.
I guess that is in part what the fight is about, though, isn't it? Keeping this around for your kids, their kids.
I think so. The world is shrinking, the natural world is shrinking, and we're blessed. This nation is blessed, and it's just worth fighting for. It's very special.
There was Tara Brown and naturalist Peter Tucker of the 60 Minutes show Battle for the Kimberley. And again, I will have a link on the website that you can go and watch this video and see this quite spectacular region. Josh Coates of Wilderness Society Australia, which is not related to Wilderness Society in the United States, recently toured the U.S. and spoke about the Kimberley region. This region, according to Coates, can only be compared to places like the Arctic and Antarctic, the Sahara and the Amazon in terms of its low levels of human impact, and especially for a tribal coastline. It presents ecological importance on a global scale. So far, it has escaped the impacts of modern industrial society. It is home to a wide variety of wildlife, including the world's largest population of humpback whales. This is their nursery area where they feed, they breed, and they give birth to their young, and where they build up their fat layer before embarking on their long migration to Antarctic waters where they feed. Here is Josh Coates.
The population has recovered well from whaling, perhaps definitely better than any other population in the world. And one of the really important reasons for that strong rebounding population is the fact that their nursery area is, up until now, a relatively unimpacted area. Also, a crucial area for five of the world's six sea turtle species. nesting beaches for a number of those species throughout the Kimberley, including the area that's in question for this gas cloud. It's also a coral reef province of global significance. Scientists are just finding out now. They're just really beginning to do the research and beginning to learn about the diversity of coral species in the Kimberley. Already they've found more corals than are found in Ningaloo Reef Area, which is quite a famous reef area in Western Australia. And I have absolutely no doubt, given the small amount of research that's been done now and the number of species that have been found to date, that the diversity of the Kimberley corals will exceed that of the Great Barrier Reef. Kimberley is also a really important last refuge for a whole range of species in the terrestrial environment as well. Many species that had a much broader range across the north of Australia, but now find themselves confined to the Kimberley region as a real last refuge, as well as a number of endemic and endangered species in the region. It's also fascinating from a geological perspective. There's the Devonian Reef System, which is an old exposed reef from the Devonian period. There's fossils throughout the Kimberley. There's also ancient rock art, some of the most ancient rock art in the world. So in terms of our heritage, not only our natural heritage, but also our cultural heritage, it's a really crucial area. It's really important in terms of global savanna health as well, really important in terms of Australian woodland health. Particularly Kimberley region is an area of really healthy tropical woodland. Another area that the Wilderness Society of Western Australia works in, by the way, is the Great Western Woodlands. That's the largest temperate woodland left in the world, and another really important area. So Western Australia really is a biodiversity hotspot, and it's important on a global scale. Same goes for rivers. The issue that I'm really here to talk to you about today is the proposal by oil and gas companies and our state government to impose a massive LNG processing facility on the Kimberley coast. Off the Kimberley coast is an area known as the Browse Basin, very rich in natural gas, to date untapped. There is proposals and a push from the state government and companies including Chevron, BP, Shell, BHP, and the operator of this project, a company called Woodside, Australia's largest oil and gas company, to be the first proponents, the first people to bring this gas out of the ground and to process it into LNG for export. Basically, this is a thin edge of the wedge development. The state government is running an agenda of industrialisation of this special part of the world. The Kimberley region is rich in a number of minerals, including bauxite, coal, uranium and a number of other minerals. So there's a number of projects, a number of developers sitting on the wings just waiting for the kind of development, the kind of port facility, the kind of access to cheap power that this LNG project would mean in terms of opening up the Kimberley, basically, for a whole range of developments. And so that's why we see stopping this development as being crucial to protecting this really important part of the world. Strip mining for bauxite is a very, very damaging process. As much as it sounds, it involves stripping the country and clearing all of the vegetation which gets burned. And the bauxite refining into aluminium is a very power-intensive process, if powered by fossil fuels. There are a number of companies with interests in bauxite mining. Norsk Hydro was one. We've been campaigning strongly for a couple of years regarding their leases and their intention to mine bauxite in the North Kimberley Plateau region. We recently had a win there. They pulled out of the Kimberley region, one of the more responsible companies on the planet, unlike some of the others like Rio Tinto, who also have interests in the area. But that was a small victory along the way. And they relinquished their leases. They didn't sell them on or anything. They just said, right, this is not going to be viable for us, for a range of reasons, including environmental reasons, and they've packed up and gone home. Now, in terms of what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico right at the moment, what I really want to convey to people is this is not an isolated incident. This is the kind of thing that's happening all the time. Late 2009, off the Kimberley coast, in the Timor Sea, we saw the Montara oil and gas rig. It was a gas rig, actually, but a lot of condensate oil was also released. A very similar disaster. The condensate oil being released into the environment for 9 weeks before they finally managed to stop the spill. Very similar scenario where the way they tried to deal with it was by drilling a relief well, multiple unsuccessful attempts before they finally succeeded in pumping mud into that well and capping it, And in the final days of the disaster, the rig actually caught fire. And it was only at that point that I believe it got any international coverage. My guess would be maybe 1% of Americans would even be aware that this happened.
Now, Coates is referring here to an event back in 2009 when a Thai-based rig operator, PTTEP, Australasia's West Atlas oil rig and Montara wellhead, about 250 kilometres off the Kimberley coast, caught fire during the company's latest attempt to plug the leaking well. On August 21, 2009, that well began spewing about 400 barrels of oil a day into the Timor Sea. And remember, one barrel is 55 gallons. 10 weeks later, a fire began burning around the cantilever portion of the West Atlas rig, which is located directly above the Montara wellhead platform. At the time, Geoscience Australia and the Australian Maritime Society Authority had been placed on standby to provide technical advice. Australian Federal Resources Minister Martin Ferguson said, and I quote, "Some of the world's leading experts are working to fix the leaking well and respond to this latest problem. I am," he continued, "seeking regular advice on this matter from PTTEP, my department, Geoscience Australia, and NOBSA, as well as some of the best minds and most experienced hands in the industry," unquote. In other words, BP is not the first company to face such conditions. They are just the last in a line of companies who regularly continue work in the face of known hazards that they apparently feel are worth the devastation that is caused when the limits of technology are reached. So let's go back to Josh Coates as he describes what ordinary people are doing to educate about the companies doing business around the world.
Recently in Houston, as part of the True Cost of Chevron network, we were there to attend the Chevron AGM to convey the concerns of tens of thousands of Australians and to convey the concerns of those shareholders who provided us with the proxies to go into that meeting. We were denied entry for no good reason. Out of the 27 activists who came from all over the world, only seven were allowed into the meeting. Now, some of the stories that I heard from those activists really were an eye-opener. Of course, I understood on an intellectual level that big oil was doing some really serious environmental and cultural damage all over the world. But to hear those stories firsthand was a real eye-opener. So in Nigeria, the kinds of spills that we're seeing at the moment are a daily occurrence. It's just, it makes the mind boggle. And it's really motivated myself to make sure we continue this fight to ensure that this kind of development isn't imposed on this really important wilderness area of the Kimberley coast. The specific area that they proposed to build this development is called James Price Point. As I pointed out, it's part of the whale nursery for the largest population of humpback whales in the world. It's home to seagrass bears, important habitat for dugong, closely related to the manatee. It's home to a really incredibly diverse filter feeding community, so sponge gardens, important habitat for species like the green turtle that feed in that habitat. And many areas along the Kimberley are home to these remnant rainforest patches from an age when the Kimberley was a little bit of a wetter environment. And these are really crucial refugia for a whole range of wildlife, especially in the late dry season. So there's some really important habitat that will be directly impacted by this development, as well as that issue of the broader impacts of the thin edge of the wedge that would come about if this development went ahead.
You are listening to Josh Coates of the Wilderness Society Australia on a region in the north of Western Australia threatened by fossil fuel energy companies and mineral mining companies setting up shop with the allegiance of Western Australia's state government. Josh Coates goes on to suggest alternatives to this industrialization and presents a well-articulated vision for the region. Before we turn to Coates, though, this is Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore. We air shows like this one each week, as well as archive all our shows for anyone to download. We are pleased to have listeners all over the world doing that. As I mentioned earlier, we had a link to the U.S. Social Forum as we try to keep our listeners involved in the big issues that affect the lives of ordinary people and what you can do about these issues. Our website is raisingsandradio.org, and we are a project of MotherSpeak and MotherSpeak Media, and we're fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. Go to the website raisingsandradio.org to find our range of progressive topics and download any shows for free. You can also purchase a CD of any shows, too, if you want to do that. And please consider making a tax-deductible donation to Raising Sand Radio or MotherSpeak at our website, raisingsandradio.org or motherspeak.org. MotherSpeak also begins a project we call This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live. We examine indigenous people and environments in Vietnam, the United States, Palestine, and South Africa. We use the lens of industrialization, and we focus on what is happening to these people and environments, and we ask what can be learned from them that can inform more sustainable ways of living and making a living in the future. We will share these voices and stories over time with you and ask you to become involved in the project too. Bring your ideas and imagination and collaborate with us. You can contact me directly at susan@raisingsandradio.org. You can also go to the website motherspeak.org, motherspeak.org, and look through our store. If you want to contribute to us and you want to purchase something, we will get a small commission from that. We also have other ways of you donating more directly to us. If you want to donate a recorder or some equipment for this Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live project, you can figure out how to do that from the website. We have an Amazon account, and you can donate directly there too. It would be great to have you involved in that way. Now let's return to Josh Coates with alternatives to industrialization in the Kimberley region of northwestern Australia.
There are alternatives even from the oil and gas company's perspective. There's absolutely no reason that they need to impose this facility on the Kimberley coast in order to remove their gas. From the wilderness society's perspective, clearly in a climate change world, the best thing to do is leave the fossil fuels in the ground where they belong and to head towards renewable forms of energy. But even if this gas does come out of the ground, there are other options for its processing. Just to the south is the Pilbara region, where the Barrow Island project and a number of other LNG projects are already underway. This is an area that has the industrial infrastructure that's required for these kind of projects already. It has the port facilities, has the power stations, has the trains, has the roads. This is the kind of area that, if this gas does come out of the ground, would be far more appropriate for its processing, rather than the pristine and beautiful with a greenfield site and the pristine and beautiful Kimberley coast. Other options include floating LNG. There's some real hypocrisy going around this. So Shell is one of the joint venture partners for their wholly owned resource in the Browse Basin. They've announced that floating LNG is their preferred option. Yet they're still going along with this proposal to impose this facility on the Kimberley coast. Woodside, the operator of this, have also decided that floating is their preferred option for their Timor Sea gas. Instead of piping it onshore to East Timor, that really wants the project, needs the economic benefits from their perspective. Not that I would inflict that, I would wish that kind of development on any community. The point of it is really to say that now is the crunch time for the Kimberley. Now is the time that we have to act. And this development that we're fighting right now is that thin edge of the wedge. And we really need to make sure that we stop that now. In the 1970s, Australia said no to oil and gas mining on the Great Barrier Reef. And as a nation, we never looked back from that decision. We went on to put into place what was then the largest marine park in the world. Now, that marine park area brings in $6.9 billion a year sustainably into the Australian economy. The Kimberley is equally naturally beautiful, it is equally naturally important, it's equally naturally iconic, yet less than 1% of the Kimberley's waters are protected in any form of marine sanctuary. We do have a real alternate vision. We're not just saying no to development. We really have clearly articulated an alternative vision, a vision of ecotourism, a vision of indigenous land management, a vision of an alternative, sustainable economy for the Kimberley, rather than a short-term and damaging industrial economy. There are a number of government processes that have been initiated in light of the attention that the Kimberley region is receiving in terms of resource extraction. There's a national heritage assessment process. There's a state conservation strategy announcement and lack of action. There's a federal Commonwealth Waters Marine Parks process underway. These are the kind of processes that need to inform and precede major industrial development decisions, not the other way around. We've got a horse before the cart situation at the moment. We put a lot of thought, we put a lot of effort into articulating the alternative, an alternative vision for Kimberley, not just saying no to what we see as a really negative impact of this proposed development, but also articulating that alternative vision. So what I'd like the people here to take home with them is that the Kimberley really is a crucially special environment. It is of global significance. It's something that we all as global citizens really should care about, and we really need to protect for future generations, for ourselves and for the health of our planet. So I would urge you all to get yourself onto the website. There's a whole bunch of different articles there that go into a lot more detail. A really crucial time in this campaign is coming up. Next month we're expecting the long-delayed environmental impact statement, called a strategic assessment report, for this development to be released for a public comment period of 1 month. This is unprecedented in Australia. This one single document is going to be used to fulfil the requirements under both the federal and the state's environmental laws. It's going to be really important that there is a strong public response, not only from the people of Australia, but from people all around the world. So I know that many of you in this room are really well connected. We would love to get that information out to your supporters and encourage them to get involved, and that's a really good way that they could make sure that their voice is heard regarding this development, this proposed development in a special part of the world.
That was Josh Coates of Wilderness Society Australia. Again, the website is wilderness.org.au. So wilderness.org.au for Australia. So an update on the Kimberley. Coates talked about the environmental impact statement that was going to that was due out. While this environmental assessment for the proposed gas plant at the James Price Point near Broome was yet to be completed and released for public comment, Woodside Corporation charged ahead and conducted seismic testing anyway. And they did this in the humpback whale calving grounds. Pregnant humpback whales have arrived in the Kimberley to give birth and mate, with Broome locals reporting sightings over the last few weeks. Despite this, as I say, the West Australia government approved the seismic surveying of the area by Woodside. The survey involves discharging an air gun below the ocean surface, emitting high-intensity sound pulses to map the site geophysically. The Environmental Protection Authority has decided there is no need to assess this activity for its environmental impact, despite previous studies showing that seismic testing affects the behavior of whales. Seismic testing should not be carried out during the period that the whales are in the area, from June to September each year. Now here is a brief spoof of an Australian news clip. We actually begin with the real news clip, and then we follow it up with the spoof in which a comedian John Clark, acting as the news anchor, asks a minister for his take on the seismic testing.
Ten's Late News with Tracy Spicer.
There are concerns tonight a whale found floating off Victoria's southeast coast could have died as a result of survey work carried out by an oil company. The whale was discovered by an ESO seismic survey crew about 26 nautical miles off Lake's entrance in East Gippsland. Sharks have been in a feeding frenzy around the carcass. Local fishermen say they're concerned about the effects underwater geological work could have on marine life. However, ESO says it hadn't started its survey when the whale was found, and the frequency given out by its equipment wouldn't hurt a whale.
This week, John Clark and Brian Dawe's attention was distracted from the election campaign by a curious story that caught their eye, but just might not have caught yours. A whale was found dead last Saturday off Lake's entrance in Victoria, in an area where a multinational energy company is conducting seismic tests for oil and gas.
Minister, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you for inviting me on the program. It's good to be here.
I'd like to ask you about this incident where a whale died this week.
Yes, very sad indeed, yes.
Yeah. What exactly happened?
This is just the one the other day?
Yeah.
In Bass Strait?
Mm-hmm.
While it died of old age?
Well, it didn't, did it?
This is the one down at Lake's entrance?
Yeah.
In the area where they do the seismic testing?
Yeah.
Yeah, died of old age.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, you don't so much know it as... It's a question of likelihood. As I understand it, that's the most likely scenario.
Was it an old whale?
Yeah, I believe it was a fairly elderly mammal, yes.
Well, how do you know that?
Well, it'd have to be, wouldn't it? I mean, you're not going to die of old age unless you're getting on a bit, are you? Have a look
sure.
at the dictionary.
Okay. But does this happen fairly often with whales?
Whales dying of old age?
Yeah.
In the areas where they do the seismic testing?
Yeah.
No, not a lot. And let me say, there was no seismic testing, as I understand it, being done in that area.
And who told you that?
The company who does the seismic testing.
The mining company.
I believe that's what they do, yeah.
Now, what is seismic testing exactly?
Seismic testing is an environmentally friendly and deeply sensitive way of firing an enormous sonic impulse into the ocean floor in order to see if there's anything down there.
And what happens if anything's in the way?
Well, there isn't anything in the way. There's just water down there. I mean, it's fired off a boat. You've got the boat sitting on the top, and then below the boat, the blue area, that's the water.
I realise that. But is there anything in the water? I mean, fish and whales and things?
Oh, there are a few critters in there, but there's a fair bit of water between them. I don't know whether you've ever been fishing, for example. You'd be aware of this ratio. There are a fair bit more water than there are critters.
Yeah, exactly. But so there are creatures down there?
Well, no, not if you're going to fire a huge sonic impulse into the ocean floor. They get out of the area pretty briskly once the trouble starts. They're not idiots.
How do they communicate with each other?
Under the water?
Yeah.
Using sound. It's very clever. It's all sort of sonar.
How do they use sonar to communicate if the mining company's firing a sonic boom into the ocean floor?
Yes, that's a very good question. Afraid I don't know the answer. I'm not a botanist.
So this old whale that died, where is he now?
It's not there anymore.
Still in the sea?
Well, nobody knows where it is. It's disappeared, apparently.
And who told you that?
The company does the seismic testing.
Well, what were they doing out there?
They were just out there making sure that there was no seismic testing being done.
Why?
Just in case anything went wrong.
Like what?
Well, if a whale's going to die of old age, for example, you wouldn't want it to happen during a seismic test.
No. Thanks for your time.
Bugger up your result, wouldn't it?
Sorry?
Sorry. Just clearing my throat.
Ten's Late News. That was a nice piece of humour, and I thought, well done. In an excellent piece of reporting for Rolling Stone magazine recently, Tim Dickinson writes in his article titled BP's Next Disaster, that even as BP continues to spin the Gulf catastrophe, they are going ahead with plans to drill in Arctic waters and avoiding the moratorium on drilling for oil near Prudhoe Bay via an oil rig it created by building on an island. He calls it a glorified mound of gravel. It's 3 miles out in state waters. Because the island rig is connected to the mainland by a causeway, BP and Interior agree that the onshore, quote-unquote, facility is not subject to restrictions on offshore, quote-unquote, drilling. Now, this is almost, it sounds so ridiculous, it's almost like the spoof we just saw, but apparently it's true. Tim Dickinson writes, first, the company will drill 2 miles beneath its tiny island, which it has christened Liberty. Then, in an ingenious twist, it will drill sideways for another 6 to 8 miles until it reaches an offshore reservoir estimated to hold 105 million barrels of oil. This would be the longest extended reach well ever attempted, and the effort has required BP to push drilling technology beyond its proven limits. As the most powerful land-based, quote-unquote, oil rig ever built, Liberty requires special pipe to withstand the 105,000 pounds of torque, the equivalent of 50 Mack truck engines needed to turn the drill. Says a BP, a top BP official, this is about as sexy as it gets, he told reporters in 2008. BP, Dickinson calls a repeat felon, is subject to record fines for its willful safety violations, and it's calling this project one of the biggest challenges to date, an engineering task made even more dangerous by plans to operate year-round in what the company itself admits is, quote, some of the harshest weather on Earth. Now, again, this is a Rolling Stone magazine that Tim Dickerson writes called BP's Next Disaster. He continues, the Obama administration has been warned by its own scientists that drilling in the Arctic poses a grave risk to the environment. Last September, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration urged the president to halt future leases in the Arctic, warning that the federal regulators operating on Bush-era guidelines had, quote, greatly understated the risks of drilling. Both industry and government, the scientists added, displayed a, quote, lack of preparedness for Arctic spill responses, unquote, and had failed to fully evaluate the potential impacts of worst-case scenarios. And what, you may wonder, is the Obama administration's response? Well, BP's project has the blessing of Minerals Management Service. You may recall this is the government agency that oversees offshore drilling. According to Dickinson, last year, 1 month after it gave BP the go-ahead to drill in the Gulf, the Minerals Management Service, or MMS, bestowed a leadership award on the company in recognition of Liberty's visionary approach to drilling. While regulators must still approve the final paperwork for the project, MMS tells Rolling Stone that it considers Liberty safe. It says that BP has the capacity to respond to a world case discharge of 20,000 barrels a day, and adds that, quote, the island has been designed to contain service liquids within the footprint of the island, unquote. Moreover, Shell has received all the environmental permits it needs to drill 5 exploratory wells in the Arctic. According to the environmental assessment that Interior conducted last December on Shell's drilling plan, quote, a very large spill from a well control incident is not a reasonably foreseen event, and therefore this environmental impact does not analyze the impacts of such a worst-case scenario, unquote. Now, Shell is the 8th largest corporation in the world with a disturbing environmental record. Last year alone, its operations in Nigeria spilled at least 100,000 barrels of crude. And again, I'm going to remind you that one barrel is equal to 55 gallons. So what is the response plan that Shell has put together in case of a disaster? Well, it says that it is only prepared to respond to a spill of 5,500 barrels a day, a fraction of the 60,000 barrels currently estimated to be pouring into the Gulf, and that's a low estimate. Shell claims that because it would be drilling in shallow waters of roughly 150 feet, its operations in the Arctic would be safer than BP's well in the Gulf, which ruptured 5,000 feet below the surface. But the government's own data shows that most blowouts occur in shallow water, and the 10-week-long gusher that followed the blowout of the rig last fall in shallow waters off the coast of Australia is proof that catastrophe can strike at any depth. The Arctic, it turns out, is not the only place that the Obama administration is poised to give oil companies a new lease on life. In another indication that the president's 6-month moratorium on deep water drilling may be nothing but a stalling tactic, MMS has continued to accept bids on drilling tracts in the Gulf. Indeed, since President Obama announced his halt to deep water drilling on May 27th, MMS has approved bids on at least 96 tracts in deep water. 2 of the bids are from BP, and 1 in the same undersea canyon where the company's gusher continues to foul the Gulf. The White House contends that MMS is simply finalizing paperwork from bids submitted prior to the disaster. But environmentalists are aghast. Quote, these new leases are based on the same fundamentally flawed and patently illegal environmental analyses used to greenlight Deepwater Horizon, says Mike Senatore of Defenders of Wildlife, which filed lawsuits against MMS in June to block the expansion of drilling. Quote, this agency is at the epicenter of the worst environmental disaster in history, and yet it's still going about business as usual. So I have a link to this full article. It's again a Rolling Stone magazine article by Tim Dickinson called BP's Next Disaster. And that is our show for the week. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, visit our website, raisingsandradio.org, to listen to other shows. Also, visit motherspeak.org to learn more about our project, This Is Who I Am, This Is Where I Live, in which we examine indigenous people and environments in Vietnam, the United States, Palestine, and South Africa. Again, we use the lens of industrialization and focus on what is happening to these people and environments and ask what can be learned from them that can inform more sustainable ways of living in the future. We will share these voices and stories over time with you and ask you to become involved in the project too. Bring your ideas and imagination and collaborate with us. If you want to contact me directly about it, it's susan@raisingsandradio.org. And today, for a little more fun, we're going to go out with the Raging Grannies doing a piece called BP, You Suck.
The USA's addicted now to fossil fuel and oil. So BP's drilling off our shore and makes our blood just boil. We warned them that the oil could spill and wash up on our soil. Halliburton and BP, you suck. You suck the oil from the sea and poison all the soil. You suck the profits from the work while others sweat and toil. You suck the lifeblood from us while you plunder and destroy. Halliburton and BP, you suck. So take your friggin' drillin' rigs and move them from our shore. Take your friggin' drillin' rigs and don't come back no more.
Take your friggin' drillin' rigs, cause we don't want your oil. Halliburton and BP,
you suck.
You bypass the inspections and ignore the warning signs.
You bribe your way to drilling rights and profit from your crimes. 11 workers now are dead and fish are swimming slow.